Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. We are in Genesis chapter 10, verses 1 through 32. It's known as the Table of Nations. It's Shem, Ham, and Japheth's genealogy, starting with Japheth, then going to Ham and saving Shem for the final of the discussion. It can be, in a sense, you know, you read through it. It's one of those chapters you do at your nightly Bible study or devotions. You fall asleep during it because you're reading these names. It's like a reading test. Can you pronounce all the names? But yet, buried in it, depending on how deep you want to go, all of history is pivoting around this chapter. This is the chapter that is going to set the stage for the world and the need for the nation of Israel, which is going to produce the salvation for all of these nations. They're all in the same boat. If you look in chapter 10 in your Bibles, we'll go through the notes. I've got 15 pages of notes, and if I go straight through those notes, it's going to be like if you remember sitting in some middle school class or a high school class or in the back of a college, lecture hall and just dozing off. That could happen tonight, and so I'm going to try to, present it to you in a way that's interesting, and yet cover the material. But chapter 10, in the NIV, it says chapter 10, verse 1, this is the account, and again, there's your word toledot. This is the written document. This is the written information. We've already had several toledotes already where they're collecting information and putting these written documents together. We're going to have more coming as far as the toledot of Jacob and on. So again, it appears that Moses, as he's putting the book of Genesis together, is using sources. He's not just sitting, like we said before, on a mountain writing under the inspiration of God, but he's collecting and weaving together sources under the inspiration of God. We're not discrediting the text of Scripture, but this is Moses working with actual documents. This is the toledot of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, who themselves had sons after the flood. Now, as these sons are going to be born, Noah's going to live 930 years or 950 years, and then his sons are going to live, 600 years, and then as we go on through here, they're going to start to decrease until they get to Abraham, who's not too many generations in front of this, to 175 years. And so these people in these chapters are living not 70 or 120 years, but they're at first living 400 years and then 300 years down to 200 years. They're living long lives. And so as that decreases by the time you get to, Joseph and his brothers, it's decreasing to, fairly normal lengths of life. And so they'll remember these people. Remember, Shem is going to be living up until the time that Isaac is born. And so these people and their long lives are going to put them in a status of like heroes. There's going to be many things about these individuals, namely Noah, because he comes from the age before the flood, and he was there for 600 years, and he's going to live 350 years after the flood. And he's going to see many of these generations be born, and they're going to start decreasing and reaching old age before Noah himself dies. And so you can imagine the image of like a hero or a legend, or even that they've tapped into some form of eternal life on these long, long lives that they've got. But the first group there, chapter 10, verses 2 through 5, that is Japheth. And on your very first page of your notes, we've got the map of Japheth on here, showing you where they're going to go. And if you look we're going to spend more detail on this. I apologize, I should have a better map. There's the Mediterranean world. We're going to put Italy over here. Here's the Tigris and the Euphrates River, the Persian Gulf. These right here, I've got three gray arrows. Japheth is going to go up into Europe, across the Mediterranean world, going north, and then he's going to go east into India, going this direction. This is Japheth, and you can see on the map where it's going. The next group is Ham. I think Japheth is the oldest son. And I think Ham is the youngest son. They're saving Shem for the last group because he's going to be the one that's going to spring off into the promised seed, the family of Abraham. But then Ham goes from chapter 10, verse 6, up through, we're going to go to verse 20. And if you turn several pages in your notes, you're going to have this map right here. It's on page 4, and that shows you Ham is going this direction. He's going to be going this way and south into Arabia and south into what we'd say Africa, Egypt. But there's also going to be, if you see how this is broken down, if you look in chapter 10, the line of Ham, you can see that it stops right around, is it verse like 18, and then it starts giving you a special group from Ham, and that's this next map, that's Canaan. Canaan has, it's almost like a fourth son. Now, we ended up talking last week about, you know, the situation with Ham and Noah and Canaan being cursed. One of the things I picked up that kind of answers some of the questions that we're trying to put it together is when Noah curses Canaan, how would he have known Canaan's name that early if there's some kind of, you know, incest that had taken place? Well, someone, I just happened to be listening to someone teach the very same thing. Of course, they were doing a better job than I was. I thought, wow, this is good. And they came to the similar conclusion, but they made a very obvious connection or with the other scriptures. Do you remember at Jacob's? You remember Jacob does the same thing. He prophesies over all of his sons. At the end of Genesis, all 12 sons, including two of Joseph's sons, get prophesied about. That's where it talks about the scepter will not depart from Judah, and talks about where they'll settle, and it's detail, it's prophecy about their future. But when does that happen? He doesn't do that at, you know, like sometime during his life. He doesn't do that at a special event. He does it at his death. He does it on his, he's on his deathbed, and he's prophesying about his sons. If you read that back into our story that we looked at last week, we all think, you know, Noah's drunk in his tent. Ham sees him naked. The other brothers cover him up. When Noah gets up, he goes, he realizes what had happened to him, and he curses Canaan. And it happens, you know, like all in, you know, in one afternoon. Well, that may have been that cursing of Canaan may have, after he saw what had happened, oh my gosh, Canaan now, and Canaan may be, you know, a young man or a middle-aged man. He may be several years old. And Noah now is dying at the age of 950, and that is when he would pronounce that curse. And so he's giving them all these directions. It would not have necessarily taken place right there at that moment. Nonetheless, that's last week, and that helps explain some things that those verses are still to be questioned. But nonetheless, beginning in chapter 10, verse 15 through 20, that's right here, and I've got the verses right here separated with its own map, is Canaan. So you can go back and look on the map on page 4, and you've got sons of Ham. You've got Cush coming down, again, coming down into this area, which is going to become the Sumerians. But also Cush is coming down into this area of Egypt. You've got Mizraim, which is the word Egypt. That's just the Hebrew transliteration. It means Egypt. And notice in Hebrew, it's Mizraim, the I am at the end. That's the plural. So it means it's not Egypt, it's Egypts. Or it's not Mizraim, it's Mizraims in the Hebrew. It's plural. And that would mean upper and lower Egypts, plural Egypts. And that would be Mizraim. And then Put is over here towards Libya. And then notice right there, the fourth Put, Mizraim, Cush, and then Ham's fourth son is Canaan, and that is all going to take place right here. So when we talk about the curse on Ham, there's no curse on Ham. Egypt's not cursed. Cush is not cursed. Put is not cursed. Canaan is cursed. And that is, look at right here, those are the land, the people that settled in the land of Canaan, Israel. And those are the people that Moses and Joshua are going to go take out. And so that is just interesting. We'll detail that later. And it includes, right here in the list, it includes the cities of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboiim. And so all that's going to play in. I got that detailed there on page 5. So that's Ham going in. So this is Japheth. This is Ham. And the last part of the chapter, the most important, again, if you want to say, again, important in the storyline of Genesis, because we're heading towards Abraham. And now in chapter 10, verse 21 through 31, you've got the family of Shem. And I've got two maps on page 9. At the bottom of page 9, I've got the big map that shows you the whole Mediterranean world, so you can see the north is Japheth, the south is going to be Ham. But then right there in this area, right in the Mesopotamian area, right here, and I've just zoomed in on it on the top map, that is the people of Shem. And it's going to go, they're going to go to the east also, but they're going to go up here north of Israel to Syria or Arameans. They're going to go up here into this area of Mesopotamia, northern Mesopotamia, and then down here, very specifically down here into Sumer, where Abraham is going to come from. And so I've got those four arrows drawn kind of there, and they're going to fill the Arabian Peninsula. So those are the general areas of those groups. Now, they're also going to then list the sons. These are where the general sons came from. The sons are all mentioned. But then the sons, I'll say this. This is one of the questions I've got, and I've been thinking about it, you know, throughout these last few weeks, is not every son is mentioned, are they? Like Noah's got three sons. Again, I'm asking a question, and I don't have an answer. Noah's got three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So he's going to get off the ark with three sons, and he's going to have no more children. Is that what we're supposed to understand? Okay, that's fine. These guys are going to get off, and Ham, they're going to have like four sons. Those are the four sons that he has, or is he going to have many more sons? Just like Adam, we know this because that's how the book of Genesis began. Adam had Cain and Abel, and then he had Seth. And then he lives 930 years, and it says, and had other sons and daughters. But it doesn't say that about Noah. It doesn't say that about Ham. It doesn't say that about Shem and Japheth. It doesn't say about these people. We've got a list of sons. We've got a list of their grandsons, sometimes their great-grandsons, and the nations. But we don't have, are we missing some sons? Again, not that it affects the scriptures at all. These are the ones that they're talking about. Are these the important ones? Now, I'll say this, and this could go this direction quite in depth, and some people haven't. I'll show you a couple books. These people, when they separate and divide at the Tower of Babel and go to their territories, these are all founders of nations. These are not just kids. These are not just people showing up at the family reunion. These are sons that went out and established a kingdom, established a culture. And everybody from that culture came from them and their wife, the original couple, the original king and queen of each of these territories. And so they're going to eventually become cultures, nations, with histories. And when those people look back and start talking about these people, where they came from, they're not necessarily going to go all the way back to Adam and Eve. They maybe aren't even going to go all the way back to Noah. They're going to go back to Shem, or the Hebrews, for example. They go back to Eber, which is the Hebrews. He's a descendant of Shem. And that is going to be who they follow. That's going to be their, because they're quickly going to divide into countries or cultures. And These guys, like I said before, are living 300 years, 200 years, and by the time they get four or five generations into their culture, they're living, you know, a normal lifespan. But these founders of these cultures are living these incredible lifespans of 400 years. And so there's going to, and they're kings. They may end up becoming part of the legends of these cultures. And they even write in the Mesopotamian tablets about when the gods were men. There's a whole line of thinking that the gods that these cultures worship, and they give them different names, they were at one point normal men on the earth, but then went to the level of deity at their death. And many of the gods, and that's what these two books right here, I'm not supporting these books necessarily, but they are. This is by a guy named Ross Marshall, Noah's Ark and the Genesis 10 Patriarchs. All these, and he goes, this is, again, see this? This is about all the names in the chapter we're studying. You want me to teach this to you? Oh my gosh. And this is one of his teachers. This guy is John Davis Pilkey. And he goes back and they connect. Basically what they're doing is they're connecting where these people settled, and they go into those cultures that developed, even going far to the east, far to the north, and whatever their gods are, you know, if it be Zeus, all of them, they trace it back to one of these patriarchs and begin to kind of speculate on the legends that were handed down. You know, a lot of it becomes legend, but a lot of it is rooted in the original people, and it branches off into the culture. That's another whole study from here. So I guess what I'm saying with that is, as we look at this chapter 10, we just got a bunch of names. Yawn, boring. But each of these names is a king, is a ruler of a country, a culture that's going to branch off, that's going to remember him as someone that lived 400, 300 years, founded their culture, is going to eventually be deified by that culture as they drift further and further from Yahweh and the truth. And the rest, of course, is history, because all these become historical. These are all historical people, and there's some traces of them left. Okay, now, with that being said, we are going to go and actually start. I'm going to read through this chapter 10. Holy smokes. I was thinking about this all day. What am I going to do? I don't want to teach the Bible without reading it. But at the same time, and again, I'm not going to pronounce all these names right. So here we go. Chapter 10, verse 1. This is the NIV. This is the account, the total of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, who themselves had sons after the flood. The sons of Japheth, and here's his major sons, Gomer, Magog, Medea, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. Those are his sons. Now it's going to list the sons of Gomer. These would be his grandsons. And it's going to be Ashkenaz, Raphath, and Togar. And I've got so many notes. Togarmar. I've got things written on this. I can't hardly see it. The sons of Javan. Now, just a heads up, Javan is going to be going over towards Greece and Italy. That's where they're going to be settling. And he gives those names, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and the Rodium. And notice the plural there again. And that would be a man named Rodan and his sons or his family, the Rodanim. From these, the maritime people spread out into their territories by their clans within their nations, each with its own language. Now, some important words here are territories. All these groups are going to be mentioned with territories or their land. They're going to be mentioned as nations, and they're going to be mentioning that they've got their own language. So these things are being written with the concept that the Tower of Babel is going to send these people out. So this is in a sense the result of what takes place in chapter 11. And again, sends them out, and they become the maritime people. This would be, you know, Europe, going east into India, and basically leaving. And again, I've got the verse written down here. We've already seen it. But Japheth was promised that his territory would expand. He'd be given great territory. The Hamites now, this is chapter 10, verse 6. The sons of Ham, Cush, Mizraim, which is Egypt, Put, and Canaan. Those are the four sons that are mentioned. And we know Canaan's going to go right there into the land of Canaan and fill that up from Sidon down to the Gaza Strip in that area. We'll talk about that. And that's got a special verse. Now here's the sons of Cush: Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, and Sabteca. Now the sons of Rama, this would be now the great-grandsons: Seba, or Sheba, and Dedan. We're going down the Arabian Peninsula. Cush was the father of Nimrod. This is, again, a great story. We'll talk about it more when we get there. I think Nimrod, and I'll give you some evidence here tonight, probably next time, that's real. This right here is Nimrod, probably Sargon. This is historically, time-wise, what he does, Sargon, the first does, he's on the tablet of the Sumerian king list, and he is going to be one that begins after the Tower of Babel, just basically collecting all the city-states into his empire and just conquering. He follows the same path, originates the same place as Nimrod, follows the general path, but nonetheless, here it is. This is called Nimrod here. I think it's Sargon. Again, that's not an absolute slam dunk, but Moses would be interested in commenting on Sargon because he's the first empire builder. Cush was the father of Nimrod, who grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That is why, notice the word Lord is Yahweh. It's all capital letters. So he was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. So at that point, there's still some remembrance of Yahweh in these cultures. They're moving away, forming their own cultures. But just like you can watch, you know, the great churches of the 15 and 1600s, as they've moved into the 18 and 1900s, they drifted off into, their own, postmodernism or whatever. And you can see churches that even in your own lifetime, they were great churches back in the 60s or the 70s teaching the Word of God, but now they've gone and they've adapted into the culture, and it's like, wait, this isn't even a Bible-teaching church. They've got their own culture. And the same thing is happening here. All these people are coming from Noah, his family, and there's a remembrance, but each generation has to make a commitment, and the further they get away from the truth, the more they fill it in with their own ideas. And so there's still an idea. They still know Yahweh. They still remember who that is. But nonetheless, Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahweh, the first centers of his kingdom were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, Kelna in Sinar. From the land he went to Assyria, moving north, where he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Kela, and Rezin, which is between Nineveh and Kelna. That is the great city. Okay, so that's talking about, and he's coming out of this land. Here's the Persian Gulf, the Tigris, the Euphrates River. This is summer. This is where the Akkadian Empire comes from. Everyone agrees. I mean, this is, the cradle of civilization. This is where writing developed. And he's coming right out of here, conquers the city-states here, and just starts moving up and expands his territory just exactly right time. I mean, we got times on this. See right here? Flood, 2458, 2357, there would be Peleg and Babel. Abraham right here, right in this time, 2357, that matches the time of Sargon. So if our timeline is correct, that we've created following the dates of the scriptures, Nimrod and Sargon are contemporaries. If they're not the same person, one of them is losing to the other one. And it doesn't appear either one of them loses. So it really seems like they're the same guy. Well, I'll move on. Verse 13, talking about Egypt, Mizraim, and again, that's plural, and so that would be probably his name is Mizra, and Mizraim was the father of the Luddites, and again, all these Anmites, the Lehabites, the Naphtalites, Okay, there's a bunch more right there. From whom the Philistines came from. So there's the Kashluhites, from whom the Philistines come from. And the Philistines, actually, we hear, are from Capdor, which is Crete. So out here, here's the Mediterranean Sea. This is the land of Israel, Dead Sea right here. Out here is Crete. They're eventually going to settle on Crete, and the Philistines are going to come back here to the Gaza Strip, probably the sea people attacking Egypt right around 1200 BC. So they're going to end up, they're going to expand out here and then come back to the Gaza Strip. That's, again, referred to in the scriptures. Canaan, now verse 15, Canaan, another son, was the father of, now these are all the people that are going to be living in the land of Canaan. Sidon would be the furthest north. Sidon would be up here, the northern part up here. Sidon, his firstborn, and of the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, the Zemarites, and the Hamathites. Again, notice right there, Hamathites, the Athites, that means peoples. So the person's name is probably Hamar. Or you've got Zamar. Or you've got Avad or Arvad. And those are the people that came from those kings that came from Canaan. And that's, you can see the map there. Later, the Canaanite clans scattered, and the borders of Canaan reached from Sidon toward Gera as far as Gaza. So it goes from Sidon up here as far as Gaza down here. And then it's going to list some cities, Sodom and Gomorrah, which is over here. So this right here is the territory. They are all in this area, and then they scattered. But they didn't scatter like Japheth. Remember, Japheth's territory would expand. Japheth is scattering up into Europe, all across Asia. They're going to scatter in the land of Canaan. Possibly the Hittites came up as far as north up here when they found the Hittite Empire. That's been excavated, and they discovered that. The borders of Canaan reached from Sidon towards Gera as far as Gaza. There's your Gaza Strip. Then toward Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboiim. Those are right out of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. They're just on the other side of the Sea of the Jordan River in the land of Jordan. These are the sons of Ham by their clans and languages in their territories and nations. Then the Semites. Sons were also born to Shem, whose older brother was Japheth. Now that is how that's all interpreted and translated. That's been a topic of debate. And I think the best answer is Japheth was the oldest son. Shem was born 2 years later. Because remember, Noah was 500 when he had his sons, but Shem was 98 when he got off the ark, because 2 years later when he was 100, he has his first son. So that would make Japheth would be born in Noah's 600th year, if you care. Shem was born in his 602nd year, and then Ham was born probably, 604th year or whatever, but would be born later. So it'd be Japheth, Shem, and Ham. Sons were born to Shem, whose older brother was Japheth. Shem was the ancestor of all the sons of Eber. And there's the father of the Hebrews, or the Heberites, or the Hebrews. The sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. Now again, notice right there, Eber's not in there. So Eber's got to come from one of them. So those are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sons of Shem. Are those the only sons Shem had? Or are those the 5 sons that established kingdoms and then that divided into other kingdoms? I don't have the answer. It just seems if you're going to live that many years, and you're talking about a popular, these guys are rebuilding the popular, there's 70 names listed here. 70 names. And that's going down into several generations, second and third generations. And so those are the only 70 people born in a 200-year period, and we're repopulating the earth. I'm not questioning the Bible. I think the Bible is identifying the kings, the leaders, those that establish nations and dynasties. But if we're going to, who are they ruling over? I mean, there's going to have to be some gaps filled in. So keep that in mind as we go through this. the sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, Meshech. Arphaxad was the father of Shelah. Now this is important. Arphaxad was the father of Shelah, and Shelah the father of Eber. So now you've got Shem, the first generation after Noah. Arphaxad, the second, was the father of Shelah, the third, who was the father of Eber, where we get the word Hebrew from. And Eber was had two sons. One was named Peleg, and the other Joktan. Now, in Peleg's day, it's going to say the earth was divided. So it appears Peleg, the earth being divided in Peleg's day, would be the Tower of Babel. I've also said before, his name means canals or channels, like divisions in the earth. That's where the water filled in the channels. Possibly if there's some kind of continental plate shifting after the flood of Noah, when the continents actually split apart. I think that happened during the flood. But if you want to put that again, 100 years, that's Peleg was born exactly 100 years after the flood. So if he's named because of the Tower of Babel division, that means the Tower of Babel happened in 2357, 100 years, 2458 after the flood. Or he's, you know, was alive during those events. And we don't have an exact date on the Tower of Babel. But if Peleg and the earth being divided, and Peleg's name sounds like division, if that's talking about the Tower of Babel, it matches there. Then Joktan was the father of, and he's got a huge list of sons, and they're all going to settle down here into the Arabian Peninsula. And I'll show you the map on that. And we could read through all that for entertainment pleasure, but I think you've had enough of me stumbling through names. Verse 30, the region where they lived stretched from Mesa towards Sepher in the eastern hill country. So it's Mesha is right about, it's part of Jordan, right about where Sodom, they went over to Jordan, right near Sodom and Gomorrah, but Mesha, then down south into the Arabian Peninsula, over to the eastern hills. Now, are the eastern hills these the mountain range over here, or is it the hills, you know, on this side of the Persian Gulf? So from here down over into this area is where Shem settled, and that is where exactly where Abram's going to come from there, and he's going to go to the land that God's going to show him, because he said, I'm going to give you the land of Canaan, because Canaan's cursed. Remember, Ham is not, all the people of Ham are not cursed. Canaan is cursed. And that is going to become the land of Israel. So that is those verses. These are the sons of Shem by their clans. Notice again, clans, languages in their territories and nations. I mean, that's going out of the way. Four times it mentions for each of these, their clans, languages, territories, and nations. I'm going to have this in my notes, but I'm going to mention it as we go by here. This chapter divides people up. Everybody came from Adam and Eve, and then it reset. Everyone came from Noah and his wife. And so when they come off the ark and they're having families and they're dividing, setting up territories with their languages, their kingdoms, they are divided up according to their tribes, their clans. There's this, and this is interesting, and it's very contemporary as far as information. There's no races. Races gives the impression of evolution, that people are different races, are evolving at different rates, that there's different, you know, like branches of the human race. That's, we've got Neanderthal, and we've got Cro-Magnon, and we've got all these, and we're all living here today, but as we know, whatever race you are is, you know, the furthest ahead race. We all want to claim Elon Musk or whatever being part of our race or whatever, maybe not. But that's evolution. That's fictional. That's this, we're clans. This is saying they're all the same family. They're all the same people. They just went off into clans. Like, I've got six sons, and they've all gone off, and they're forming their own families, and give them enough time, they'll have their own clans. And you know your own family. I've got cousins. We've all got all of our cousins, as everybody, all of our parents were all one family. But by this time, I'm so distant from my cousins, I've got my family, I'm even distanced from my own siblings. And so That's what's happening here. That doesn't mean we're different races. It means we've divided into our own clans, our own families. And so this right here is just coming against so many things that we talk about in our culture that is being used as a source of division and is caused by false philosophies and false science. Okay, verse 32, these are the clans of Noah's sons. Once again, it says it again, these are the clans of Noah's sons. It doesn't say these are the races of Noah's sons. How can that be? How can you have races from Noah? And again, you go, if this date is correct, how advanced is one race over the other race if we're talking about 4,000 years? I mean, it's like, for evolution to really shoot one race, there's going to take millions of years for the genetics to adapt. It's like, there's no time. We're all the same family. And again, that can be repeated scientifically. We've got other examples we've talked about before, especially the idea that within a thousand years, everybody on Earth right now, going back a thousand years, has a common ancestor. Everybody in this room, if I can say I'm related to, and I can, Charlemagne, that's far enough back that everybody in this room could have some connection to Charlemagne. Because that's just the math. That's the way the math, that's both mathematically figuring it out, but also DNA proves that fact. Nonetheless, these are the clans of Noah's sons according to their lines of descent within their nations. From these, the nations spread out over the earth after the flood. Now, with that being said, I'm on page 13 of the notes. I'm going to give you a bunch of information and read through just some points here. And first, I've got three Bible verses that look back to this chapter, this event. And the Bible is based in this concept. Paul, when he goes to Athens, he's going to go to the people of Javan in Greece, if they're descendants from Japheth through Javan, and he's going to meet with them because they've got their own gods, and possibly some of their gods date way back to some of these patriarchs in this chapter. And so he's addressing them philosophically, talking on Mars Hill or the Areopagus. He says, the God who, and you know the verse, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything. Again, there's a concept. Remember the gods that after the flood, they gathered around the offering, according to the flood legends, because the gods were hungry, because man had been away in the flood and there was no one to feed the gods, so they gathered around the offerings. It's like, so a lot of these gods, you're giving them offerings for them to eat. Well, God doesn't need food, and that's not what the offerings that the Jews presented him was, not he doesn't need food. Nonetheless, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. Everywhere on the earth where man lives, they come from one man, Paul says. Having determined, now this is interesting theologically. He's where they're at because having determined allotted periods, these are time periods for these peoples, these nations to live, and the boundaries of their dwelling place. Now we can see this a classic example of Daniel's prophecy, the statue of the head of gold and bronze and iron and clay, bronze, silver, gold, silver, bronze, iron, and clay. But he tells specifically how long they're going to last. He's getting that information from an angel who's reading from the Book of Truth that apparently is in heaven. And in that Book of Truth apparently is who the nations are going to be, how long they're going to be a nation, and what territory they're going to live in that nation. Which is scary because, you know, go America, we had our time where we came into existence, we had our time where we've done great things, and according to the pattern of history, There's a time where we're going to be like put on the shelf and someone else is going to come into our territory. Now, I hope it's not, I hope it doesn't start, you know, tonight or November. I hope we go on for another 100 years or 1,000 years. Now, that sounds kind of Nazi-ish. I shouldn't say that. 1,000 years, the great kingdom, you know, that's the millennial kingdom. But there is an ending to all these kingdoms rise and fall. The people, you know, continue to move around. Nonetheless, Paul says, having determined allotted periods and boundaries on their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards Him and find Him. Yet He actually is not far from each one of us, for in Him we live and move and have our being. Meaning men are searching for Him, but the very fact you're searching for Him is kind of crazy because your existence is within God. I mean, everything, He is here everywhere. And then he says, even your own poets have said. And when he says poets, their poets were considered philosophers. Their own philosophy has said, and he quotes, we know the poet he quotes from, we know the poem, the philosophy, for we are indeed his offspring. He quotes a Greek author and says, your Greek author nails this concept. Even your own poets, your own philosophers are saying the same thing. They've come this close. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of men. And so that is Paul addressing this very concept as he's getting ready to present the gospel, because this, the division, the nations coming out of Babel, the answer to this is going to be Abraham and the nation of Israel. Okay, Deuteronomy 32, 7 through 9. This is Moses teaching the Israelites. He says, remember the days of old. Now, it's 1440 to 1446 BC. And so we're within 1,000 years of this event. And so when Moses says, remember the days of old, he's 1,000 years away from this chart. Remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, and he will show you, your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High, that's God, gave to the nations their inheritance. Now, what inheritance did he give them? Well, he's giving them territory. He's giving them boundaries. He's giving them nations. In fact, we can see in Acts chapter 17 and in Daniel, he's giving them time periods on how long they're going to exist. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples. The borders were fixed according to the number of the sons of God. You see that? The borders were fixed according to the numbers of the sons of God. Now, that sons of God is either referring to Israel, the children of God, or it's referring to angelic beings, the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. But the Lord's portion is His people. In other words, it gives the impression, possibly, that each of these nations were divided up and then were assigned a heavenly authority. Is that possible? Absolutely possible. In fact, who is the angelic authority over Israel? Michael. We know that Michael is the prince of Israel. And when Gabriel was coming to bring a message to Daniel, he had to fight against the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece. Now, he's not fighting, Gabriel is not fighting hand-to-hand combat with a mortal. He's having a conflict that Michael had to intervene and help him fight off the angelic authorities of the power of Greece, or the nation, the empire, the kingdom, the territory, the language, the people of Greece, and the people and territory of the Persians. And so that can mean, I'll go with this also. There's 70 nations that are going to be mentioned here. There's going to be 70 sons of Israel that are going to match them. When Jesus has his 12, he also has the 70, and the 70 were sent out to the nations. So this ideal of the 70 nations, 70 sons of Israel, the 70 being chosen, not just 12, but then there was a group of 70, And then Jesus sends them out, go into all the nations. It all somehow is fitting together. Again, I'm not going to go on that much longer, but that's just interesting when it says, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the numbers of the sons of God, but the Lord's portion is his people. In other words, it's as if he says, okay, I'm going to divide these up, right here, I'm going to divide these up, and I'm going to give them a power or authority, a angelic ruler, prince, to oversee them. And God does put angels in charge of the waters, angels in charge of the weather, angels in charge of the wind. Angels are in charge. There could be angels overseeing these empires or these nations. We know that's the case. And if Israel's got one, Persia's got one, Greece has one, do other nations have one? I would assume so. But they were all divided up. But then out of those 70, he's going to grab one man, Abraham. Come here. Out of all these nations, they're already divided up against the sons of God. He says, Abraham, come here. I'm going to make a great nation out of you. And through you, we're going to bless all these other nations. They're all going to go into rebellion, but I'm going to bless them through you. And that's what it says right here. He divided the nations up according to the sons of God, but the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted inheritance. God says, Israel is my people. You can have the other nations, but in the end, I'm going to win the other nations through Israel, through his Messiah. Amos 9, 7 through 8, again, this is interesting. Talking again, Amos the prophet talking to the people of Israel, are you not like the Cushites to me? Now, do you remember the Cushites? Again, I apologize about my map. The Cushites came down, and let's do something better than this. Here is... again, if this even makes sense to you, there's the Tigris, the Euphrates. Here is the Mediterranean Sea, Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. And then here is Egypt. Now, Cush settled here, and Cush settles in Egypt. They're going to be settling two places. So he says to Israel, Amos, 600 BC, sometime around 600 BC. Are you not like the Cushites to me, Israel? O people of Israel, declares the Lord, how are they like the Cushites? Did I not bring up Israel from the land of Egypt, in the very land that Cush settles? Did I not bring you up out of there? You mean you're just like all the other nations, except I brought you out of Egypt to the promised land. Did I not bring up Israel from the land of Egypt, and the Philistines from Caphtor? Now again, we talked about that before. The Philistines are going to come from Greek, or the islands, Crete, and they're going to settle right here. So he says, we already saw him establish their boundaries, their territories, and now he's moving them around as he wants to move them, and he's bringing Israel up out of Egypt. And the Syrians from Kir. And the Syrians are going to live right up in this area. The Arameans are going to come up from Kir. Meaning, did I not move you around and put you where I want you? Behold, the eyes of the Lord are upon the sinful kingdom, and I will destroy it from the surface of the ground, except that I will not utterly destroy the house of Jacob, declares the Lord. In other words, these nations, I move them around as I want to. When they go through the four cycles, the fourth cycle of judgment, they will be eliminated from history. And Israel, he says, how are you not like the Cushites, or the people that came from Crete, or the Arameans? He says, the difference is, I will punish you, but I'll always save a remnant. And so they're in a position where they themselves are going to be judged. So anyway, there we see God dividing the nations up. There's a listing of them. He's overseeing it, even at our own time. Now on page 14, here's a list of information for this chapter. Number one, there's no parallel in these chapters in antiquity. We can find things talking about the flood. We can find the place where the languages were scattered. We can find information, even like the seal, the Garden of Eden seal, talking about a serpent and a woman. We find stuff like that. But there's no list like this in antiquity, mainly because they think of they're going to have their king, or they're going to have their father, their origin that's going to begin their nation. And they, in a sense, they're going to skip the creation, the beginning. They're going to have this king, and many times their king, this patriarch, is going to become a God, and that God is going to found the nation. And they then are going to continue to worship this God, give him, it won't be a name, it could be similar to what we see here, but they'll have their own tongue, their own language of calling Noah a different name, Shem or Ham or Japheth a different name, or whoever the patriarch is. So there's nothing this detailed and as accurate, and this map can be overlaid with history and see these people groups yet today as they came from. So there's nothing like this in antiquity. Point two, these verses are once again picked up in 1 Chronicles in chapter 1, verses 4 through 23. They repeat these. They record them again. Abraham's nation is the divine answer to man's problems concerning the nations in darkness. These nations are going to go off. They're going to forget Yahweh. But Abraham is going to be now, coming up in chapter 12, is going to be called to solve this problem. Of course, Abraham doesn't fully understand it, or maybe I don't fully understand what Abraham did understand. The spreading mankind over the earth, after the Tower of Babel, we'll read about that in a couple of weeks. The spreading out of mankind over the earth, it sounds like a judgment, because God said, fill the earth, and they stayed around and they just conglomerated and did their own thing, building the city. No one's going to destroy us. But spreading mankind over the earth was not God's punishment to destroy them, but God's discipline to actually preserve mankind. And we're you talk end times, we can slip into end times very easily. If they were not dispersed at the Tower of Babel, we don't know how disastrous world history would have been. If they were allowed to just stay there in their own controlled setting and one language, one tongue, and God himself says, nothing will be impossible for them. I mean, we can go back, we haven't got there yet, but coming up here, I'm looking at the verse right now. Right here. The Lord, chapter 11, verse 6, the Lord said, this is a shocking verse, and just allow this to just become a little science fiction for you. Allow your mind to drift about, all that's possible with AI today and a one world government and all the things that we can do, the development of DNA, the combination of technology and computers with the human brain. This is what God says in chapter 11, the next chapter in our study. If as one people speaking the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. That is not an opinion of King David or an opinion of King Jehoshaphat or one of the Pharisees that was questioning Jesus. This is God speaking in the Trinity. They're talking as a Godhead. He says, if they've come this far and this is their attitude, nothing will be impossible for them. They will completely... Remember, Jesus says, talking to end times, if those days, when the Antichrist manifests in the temple, sets himself up to be God, the image starts to speak, everyone's deluded and deceived, and he begins to kill Christians and Jews, this Antichrist, Jesus says, if those days were not cut short, there wouldn't be any flesh left. He says, that persecution will begin, but I will intervene and stop it because, well, right back here, nothing they set their mind to will be impossible. In other words, if the Antichrist, with the human potential and all the technology backed up with satanic power, decides, I'm going to just kill everybody that doesn't worship me and follow me and accept the mark of the beast, which is a guarantee of eternal damnation, if those days were not cut short, he would have done it. He would have done it. And so God intervenes prophetically at that point. Jesus says, if those days are not cut short, he says it twice. Well, right here, they're on the verge, maybe the time frame, the trajectory. What were they able to do here, and what were they going to begin doing quickly if God had not says, no, I'm going to confuse you. You won't be able to talk to each other. You're not going to be able to take Elon Musk and all of his strategy and then rescue the space, the people lost in space because the U.S. government messed it up or something. And then he's going to come in and he's going to solve the problem in the White House. Elon Musk is like, he can solve all the problems. He's got an Uber going up to save the spacecraft. Trump's going to bring him into the White House. Nonetheless, that's this point right here, point four. Spreading mankind over the earth was not God's punishment to destroy, but God's discipline to preserve mankind. So that this whole scattering is part of the plan of salvation. And the first thing he does then after this, he goes and gets Abraham and starts the plan of salvation. Point five, their similar words are used in chapter 10 and 11. The word territories are earth. You can see the Hebrew word eres. Language, the two words for that is used. Several places, languages is used in chapter 10 and 11. Dispersion of the people with words like spread, scattered, divided. Babylon and Shinar are mentioned. Eastern or eastward is mentioned several times. Building of cities is mentioned. And as always, it seems like building of cities is in a negative context. Even in the book of Revelation, cities, Babylon the Great, is negative, which makes you kind of rethink some things. Point six, the three sons, Japheth in verse 2, ends with territories, language, clans, and nations in verse 5. Ham, verse 6, ends with clans, language, territories, and nations in verse 20. Shem in verse 21 ends with clans, language, territories, and nations in verse 31. Japheth is the oldest, we've talked about that, and the promised seed will come through his line. That is a mistake. Why did I write that down? Japheth, Oh, I know why. I know why. I switched those around. These notes I used before, I used to have Shem up there. So cross that off right there. I originally had in my notes from like 2007, Shem is the oldest and promised seed will come through his line. I've changed my mind about who the oldest is, and Japheth is the oldest, but I had that in the same sentence with will come through his line. So that's a mistake, because today when I do in my notes, I switch Shem and Japheth around in those statements. So D and E are incorrect. Japheth, point G, Japheth has 14 nations. Ham has 30 nations mentioned. Shem has 26 nations mentioned. It's a total of 70 nations. There are 70 elders that represent Israel on Mount Sinai. That's where the sons of God could be, those 70, or the sons of God could be angels. And there's 70 disciples are sent out by Jesus in Luke 10. In Genesis 12, Abraham is called to bless these nations. Acts 1:8, the apostles are told to go to the ends of the earth. Acts 2:5-11, there were people from, this is interesting, chapter day of Pentecost, there were people from every nation under heaven in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. So with this map we had here, if you take that literally, there was representatives from every one of those nations in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. And that means every nation heard the gospel and could take it back to their nation. Classic example is the Ethiopian eunuch who's in a chariot. He sees Philip. Philip brings him, and he takes the message back to Ethiopia, and Candace, the queen, becomes a believer. Point seven, the Bible distinguishes people. This is what I said earlier, distinguishes people as tribes, clans, and national groups that all come from Noah. Point A, B, C, and D, see if you can keep up with this. Evolution uses the word race, which places people groups in different levels of the evolutionary scale. B, the DNA difference between any two people is, again, this is not confusing, but I'm using numbers here, between any two people is 0.2%. That is how close every person is in the world. I'll read that again. The DNA difference between any two people is 0.2%. But of this 0.2%, only 6% of this 0.2%. So, I mean, this is not 6% of the 100. This is 6% of the 0.2. Only 6% is due to what we'd say race. Say Asian or Caucasian is what we use here. 6% difference in this 0.2% is because of what race you come from, what part of the world you grew up in, or what race you come from in that world. But of this, watch this, this gets even better, Of this 0.2%, only 6% is due to race. Point D, 85% of this total 0.2% difference between two people occurs within their own race. So 6% is between races. 85% of this 2% occurs in your own race. Meaning there's no such thing. I mean, we can identify race because there's a difference between countries, but you're talking about 6% of 0.2%, which is nothing. It's just basically genetics from that territory, and it's got very little impact. Interesting. Okay, and point eight, how did the different skin colors originate? It talks about melanin. Is that how you say it, melanin? Before the Tower of Babel, people lived together in Shinar. There, that's good right there. We're going to pick this up next week. I apologize. And look at a little bit more detail of those people. And I want to spend some time next week talking about Peleg and a little more detail about Sargon, just to make a point of that. And then we'll move on to the Tower of Babel. I'll pray, and we are done. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the truth. We live in times that are deceiving and confusing with information that has been twisted, not just in our own generation, but throughout time, that poor information has been brought to us. We do thank you for preserving the truth and want you to see our hearts that are desiring and hungry for the truth, that we may walk in the truth, speak the truth, and produce more followers of you at this time in history. We do ask that we would, again, do the things you've called us to, and that you would continue to lead us and guide us and keep our eyes open and keep us away from deception. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.